This is Ken Powell, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 30th of April, 2012. Ken Powell, Part 2.
Tell me about Deuce Bay, Ken, because you were established, you were involved in establishing Deuce Bay, I think, weren't you?
As far as I remember, there was a significant difference in the meteorological conditions, and they decided it was important to have a temporary base. And this was prefabricated and sent down, and then a number of us were a relay in the material for the base and the instruments, and it was stored at Deuce Bay, which was about 20 miles to the south of us, over a peak, and down into the next bay, and the bay was about 12, 15, 20 miles wide. You had to cross the bay, and then we built the hut on a rock outcrop, which was about 20 foot above the sea ice, and Murdo Tate and I were given the job of building the hut and setting it up, which we did. It was about 8 foot square, two bunks, a table, chairs, and the Met instruments. And we systematically built the hut and then stayed on for a fortnight doing Met observations, and then were relieved by two other chaps. And it was maintained for about 4 or 5 months. I don't know whether the meteorological, whether it proved anything. I never heard anything about that. And then we spent quite a bit of time going along the coast of Deuce Bay while we were there.
Can you describe the hut to me? Was it very, very rudimentary?
Well, it was a stand. It was tongue and groove board planking with a flat roof, a sloping roof, and it came in a flat pack. So we just assembled it.
All the way from the UK?
I don't know whether it was from Port Stanley, but whether I don't know where it came from. It was pre-made. All we had to do was assemble it. But we were living in a tent while we were doing that, and it was much. We had the same rations as though we were in a tent. Same. And we still had the dogs to look after, of course.
Was this an easy build, or, as usual, were there some bits missing?
No, it was straightforward. It just went up, no trouble at all. We carved a groove in the on the outcrop and levelled it, and then built the hut. It was straightforward.
Were you carving a groove into the rock or into
No, it was a sort
ice?
Of shaley... it was a rock with... sort of slightly gravelly, rugged. I mean, I think with an ice axe, we just levelled it enough for the purpose, and then probably put some wedges under the other end to chock it up so that it was level.
Did Deuce Bay have its own generators?
Oh, no. It was just as though you were in a tent.
Oh, right.
Primus. Just a Primus was the only power, and probably a tilly lamp. I can't remember, but it must have been stayed, you know, because of the wind. There must have been hawsers and pickets to stay the hut.
Mm. Tell me about Murdo Tate.
Oh, he was interesting. He was a Scot. He came from Wick. In northern Scotland, and for a number of years he'd been a lighthouse keeper, particularly on Skerry Vore, which was one of the islands, In fact, one tale he had is as lighthouse keepers, it was decided that they had to put new lino down, and rolls of lino came, but it was checkered. It was black and white check. They were about 18-inch squares in black and white check. But, of course, they had to lay the lino in this totally circular space, and it took them an awful time to cut it, you know, so that it fitted. Yes. And then he went down to the Port Stanley and became a shepherd, and it was whilst he was working as a shepherd that he heard about, you know, he applied to Government House and became a FID, and then came down. But he had all sorts of skills that were useful on a base.
Such as?
Well, splicing and rope work. And of course, he was quite a good cook, because of being a lighthouse keeper and having to cook his own dinners. Yes, and he always had a great many tales to tell. And I told you that tale on the previous base that he'd been on, how one of the members who could send radio signals in Morse took the sledge radio, climbed onto the roof of the hut and sat over the radio cabin, waited for the wireless operator to come on air, and then sent out this distress signal, apparently coming from the Queen Mary, which was wedged in the sea ice in the Weddell Sea. And this weak signal was carefully transmitted, and the apparently the wireless operator for the time was taken in and was about to sort of send it off to Paul Stanley when, but, you know, sitting on the roof of the radio cabin was the wireless operator from the Queen Mary stuck in the Weddell Sea.
Well, practical jokes part of everyday life?
Not once or twice, but not...
There was no culture yes. of it. You were with Murdo at Deuce Bay when Everest was conquered.
That's right.
Now, how did you find out?
Well, we were listening... the sledge radio could... receive the news bulletin from Cape Town, you know, from South Africa. We found we could get the frequency to get a news bulletin from Cape Town, like the 6 o'clock news. And it was on that we heard that Hillary and Tenzin had climbed Everest. And, you know, had conquered Everest. It was quite an event. And the other thing that happened was the coronation in 1953. That was...
Same day.
Yes, same day. That was it. So, as I said, we celebrated the occasion with extra helping of pemmican.
By royal appointment.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, the story is that the news of the conquest of Everest was held back for a day or two.
So it could
be announced on the morning of the coronation. I interviewed John Hunt, who led the expedition
many years ago.
He told me that story. You were showing me some of your photographs, and one of your photographs actually got into the newspapers.
Yes. Yes, it was a photograph of the John Biscoe.
Ken has quite a wadge of prints in black and white, of course. This is a carpet job. Oh, there we are.
I got it ready before he came. Oh, here.
This is from the Times, the 20th of May 1955, and there's the John Biscoe, the Falkland Islands Dependency Survey vessel, on her way through the Lemaire Channel to the British base on Argentine Island. An order has been placed with Fleming and Ferguson Limited Paisley for a new survey vessel to take the place of the John Biscoe, which will be withdrawn from service next year. That's a remarkable photograph. Yes. You must have stood on the ice itself to get that.
Well, yes, I did. The ship was stationary in the ice, and you climbed down the rope ladder and then stood on the ice, and I got £20 for that.
In 1955?
In 1955, yes.
That's a fair price, isn't it? You're not mentioned though. There's
no photography credit. No.
They wouldn't even credit the journalists in those days. Why are they very much, except the famous ones. Well, that was an achievement. So you presumably when you got back to the UK, did you just print the negative off and send it to them?
No, I went to somebody I knew who was called Polar Photos.
Oh yeah.
And he made a point that he was a journalist. He worked for the BBC, and he as a sideline he had this contact with newspapers.
We mentioned Julian Taylor, the vet, a while ago, and there was quite a concerted breeding program, wasn't there, at Hope Bay?
Yeah, so I understand. Yes.
You weren't party to
no,
that anyway.
No.
Okay. And what about the other end of the dog's life? What was the fate of the poor dogs who'd seen their active service out?
Well, they had to be shot, and again, there was a deep crevasse that we'd earmarked for that, and one or two of us or three of us would shoot the dog, put a round through its head and put it into the crevasse, and then sort of stand in silence for a minute or two in deference.
Mm. It was not a popular
job. Oh, no. And sometimes the injuries from fights could be quite severe. You know, they could tear each other. I mean, there were tales from the Eskimos that they used to hang a dog up and extract its molars to stop it severing the towing rope, or we had one dog with its stomach ripped open and the intestines sort of trailing, and we had to put it down, had to put an ice axe through its head because we were sledging and we hadn't got a rifle with us. And just, I took a sort of deep breath and then put the ice axe straight through its head and then put it in among some ice and buried it.
Mm. Not a popular
but
job.
The 2 years living with 60, 70 dogs, they're a major part of your life. The conversation, a great deal of the conversation is about the dogs. I mean, you're cut off from the outside world. News bulletins occasionally. I mean, the main event when I was down there was the attack on Suez. But, you know, weren't all that interested. What the dogs were doing was of more interest.
Did you felt that detached from the real
yes.
outside world?
Oh yes, yes. No newspapers. I mean, just letters from home came in over the radio once a month. You had a letter from home and sent a letter home.
Was the remoteness part of the attraction for you? The fact that you weren't bombarded by the rest of the world's
Not sort of specifically on the way down. You know, I didn't go down for that reason. But thinking back, I found I didn't have any difficulty living out the time. It seemed to go. I wasn't fighting it. Mm. I was always read a lot, and I did a lot of reading down there. And the one book that I seemed to look most to was a collection of poems called Other Men's Flowers, published by a famous general, Wavell. He had taken all these poems with him into battle. Wherever he was, he had these particular collection of poems, and he published it. But I used to read that avidly. But I didn't. I mean, obviously, there were times when you were fed up with the passing of time. But the two groups of people who are very widely read: Antarctic explorers and prisoners. Chaps who've done time in prison have also read all the books that are about.
So the library at Hope Bay was adequate, was it?
Yes, there was there was the books that we each bought, we exchanged, and there was a good collection of polar literature. You know, you had time to read through Shackleton and Scott and so on.
Did you feel, because you were in huts not dissimilar to those that Scott used, or in tents not dissimilar to those that the other polar explorers had. Did you feel connected to them at all?
Yes, there was a, you did feel a connection, and particularly there was that members of Scott's party who lived in an ice cave. They lived in an ice cave for quite a few months, and the sort of social niceties that they drew, they scored a line in the ice across the cave, in the floor of the cave, to demark the officers' quarters and the other ranks, and they separated because they found they could get on better if they stayed with their own types.
Gentlemen and players.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And I mean, Scott and particularly Shackleton was something of a mentor. And going to South Georgia and seeing his grave in have you been to South Georgia?
No, I Griplicum, haven't.
And there's his grave, because and then after the First World War, around about 1924, he was on another expedition and had a heart attack and died and was buried in South Georgia. And there it is. You go and sort of look at it and.
Did you ever meet any of the chaps in the Heroic Era? Priestley?
I met the famous geologist. He was in the Antarctic Dinners. I used to go to the Antarctic Dinners until I moved to Lincolnshire and lost touch. There was a famous geologist who was on Shackleton's expedition. In fact, he made rather a good speech. He'd said that since he was the only member of the expedition still alive, and since he'd only got one testicle, the expedition isn't in very good shape. I know his name, but
I'll
can't.
I'll look it up, don't
I can't,
worry.
Yes.
I'll look it up. Yeah. Whatever happened to the bath at Hope Bay? Because they delivered one, didn't they?
In the year before I was there, they delivered it, and they were they're unpacking the bath. And the hut is surrounded by compacted snow and ice. And they unpacked the bath, put it to one side on the snow, went in and had a cup of tea and a smoke. And whilst they were having their tea, a gust of wind got up and it blew the bath away on the snow and glare ice. It just went and it was never seen again. So they solved the problem by making a bath out of a diesel drum. They took a standard diesel drum, cut it in half longitudinally, knocked the two ends out, riveted them together. They put a rubber sheet between the two and then riveted it so that it was watertight, put it on wooden chocks, and that was our bath. And that when we got there, that was what we used. As you sat down, you could feel the ridges, you know, in the bath. But it worked, and you bailed it out. You didn't drain it, you bailed it out. Yes.
And when you bail the water out, you presumably had a certain amount of time to get it out before it froze.
Oh, well, you'd be indoors, you see. It was in the same temperature. So you had a bucket and you bail it out, and then you took the bucket and you put the warm water, as it was, down this special ice hot well for waste, you know, and that so the warm water melted a bit and it got deeper and deeper.
So the waste got deeper and deeper,
yes.
As well. Oh, I see. Double.
Yeah. And then when there was, yes, in this well, when the waste was about 10 foot down or so at a certain time, you'd put a whole mass of ice in and seal it off and then start another one.
Mm. Tell me about the move to Halley, because you were signed up originally for 1 year, then 2 years at Hope Bay.
Yes.
Did you come back in the meantime, or did you go straight to Halley?
No, I came back. Or for a few months, and then I was a friend of George Hemming. In fact, we were sharing a flat in Putney, and the International Geophysical Year and the setting up of the scientific base at Halley came up, and there was an opportunity to be in the advance party to help set up the base. So I became the diesel mechanic in the advance party. And having got down there in a Norwegian sealer, the Totten, which was about 350 tons, a Norwegian sealer, we patrolled the coast of the Caird coast, went ashore and did a survey and decided where the hut should be. And then David Dalglish, the base leader, formally took possession of the area in the name of the Queen, as a British British territory. And then we took something like 200 tons of stores ashore, sledged them up probably about 2 miles, and built the hut. And it was about 100 foot by 40 foot. And yes, built the hut, and I installed 4 generators, wired the hut for lighting and power. And it was all ready for this when the main party of scientists came in a year later.
So were you there? Did you winter at Halley?
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes.
So you went 1 year, worked on the hut over the winter, then
that's
the spring
it.
Came.
Yes, and in fact, it was that much colder. I think we had a lowest temperature was about minus 46, 47.
Was it just another job, another hut, or was there anything particularly special about the fact it was part of the IGY?
It really was a standard hut. Pretty standard. We had lived in tents while we were building it. Nothing. It was pretty standard.
Did you get a sense of history being made, though, this particular year?
Well, the fact that it was a new territory, that it was for the International Geophysical Year, gave it a certain sort of eminence. And it was on the ice cliff was about 80 foot high, and then it was just an ice plateau. But in the distance, on certain days, there was this shadowy way, and we decided it was a mountain range. And David Dalglish had sort of reported this and looked at it through binoculars and gave it the name the Totten Range after the sealer. Mm-hmm. And it's the Totten Range. The lights, the aurora in Halley was distinctive.
In what way?
Well, it was so bright, this great sort of illuminated sky at night was quite fantastic. I mean, occasionally we saw it at Hope Bay, but it was much more definite at Halley Bay.
Multicoloured?
Oh, yes, this great aurora.
What sort of shapes did it?
Well, it wasn't like a rainbow. It was great, like a marbled mosaic.
Would you spend some time outside looking at it?
Oh, yes, we did, and anticipated it. And
every night?
No, it came for 2 or 3 nights and then disappeared for quite a long time. Hmm. We had colour film and took photographs of it.
So you were in the hut, you were in the tents whilst you built the
hut? Oh, yes, for about 6 weeks or more.
Right, and then you moved into the hut itself?
Yes.
And then carried on fitting it out from inside?
Yes.
But then you came home, you weren't there for the IGY year?
No, I came home, for the end of 1 year.
Let me ask you a couple of questions about... at the end of your year at Halley, you also invented a mobile generator.
Well, towards the end of the year, we got information over the radio that the incoming party were going to install new generators, larger generators for the scientific work. And I thought, well, what's to be done with the existing generators? So I decided a portable power unit would be useful. And I got an old packing crate, which was about 6 foot square by about 8 foot long, mounted this on a rough sledge made of two planks made into runners with 4x2 cross members and a towing loop, put the packing case on top of that, screwed it, bolted it in, and then installed one of the diesel generators in the packing crate, complete with fuel tank and exhaust pipe and starter handle. And then on the outside of the crate, in a covered box, put the switch gear and the sockets, the 13-amp sockets, so that it was quite a portable power unit, and it could be towed wherever lighting and power tools were needed. And I did that and left it, gave it to the incoming party, but I heard later that it was very, very well used. It was used for all sorts, because they had a lot of other buildings to do, and while they were doing the building, they had a source of power, particularly for the power tools.
Could it have left base? Could it have gone on a sledging journey?
Oh, no. It needed a tractor, and the runners were anything but efficient.
So that was your parting gift, was it, Charlie?
Yes.
Yeah. On the way back, you spent a little while in the Falklands, both on the way south and north, and you spotted the SS Great Britain in its dilapidated state.
Well, we are on the way down. One day we had to go round in a very large motorboat. I can't remember the name of it. There was store in there was a hull, an old hull, an old hull, no, a hull, in the next bay, which was used as a store, as a depot for stores, and we were sent round to collect so many stores from this hull and bring them back, to take them down south. But it was only afterwards I realised that this hull was, in fact, the Great Britain.
Mm. Interesting story, yes. Yeah.
It was complete, it was we saw it as a sailing ship, two great masts, a steel hull, with quite a bit of storage. Yes.
Let's talk a bit about what you did when you got back, because having spent 3 years on ice, you then moved into water.
Yes. I took a short course in surveying, because that's, had been doing that and some meteorological work and some surveying in the Antarctic. So I took a short course in surveying, and then I applied for a job. Found out about the Hydrological Survey of Iraq. There was a consultant's just off Victoria Street advertising, and I went for an interview. And this was to measure the flow, the flow of the rivers Tigris and Euphrates. And I got the job and went out to Iraq, and was stationed in Kirkuk, which is about 150 miles north of Baghdad. And we worked as a team, measuring the main channels and the tributaries of the Tigris and the Euphrates, either by a boat or by a portable cableway. Mm. We also had, in the winter, we had to go up into the mountains on the Iranian border, up to about the 9,000 foot level, and measure the water content of the snow, because when it melted in March, that was a contribution to the flooding that could harm Baghdad. And the trip, about once every 3 weeks, that's a month, it was quite a long trip up into the mountains, and the journey was in three parts, by Land Rover, on mules, and on skis.
Were you the only FID working in Iraq at that time?
No, there were three others, Brian Gilpin and another one I can't remember. And the chap who organised it was Mike Mansell Moulin. He hadn't been down south, but we worked as a team, and it was very good. It was quite enjoyable. And often in remote desert places.
Yeah, desert concept again. They're very attractive, aren't they?
Yes. Deserts? Well, I think being an ex-FID, you were a reliable sort of bloke to be working in these places. You know, you there were quite a lot of jobs going for ex-FIDs because, you know, in remote parts of the world, just because you'd proven yourself to be reliable in isolation. Yeah. Yeah.
You're the only FID I've met who got married in Baghdad.
Yes, whilst I was out there, I'd proposed to Jean before before I got the job. We were engaged, and then this job came up, and I said, well, you know, if I'm going to get married, I better get some money, and went out, I was going to come home to get married, but there was quite a lot of work on, and they gave me a promotion, but they said we can't really spare the time for you to have a month off or whatever. So we arranged that Jean came out and we were married in the British Embassy in Baghdad.
How was that?
Well, it was quite interesting because I had two witnesses, but went into the consul did the carried it out, and into his office, there was his desk with a Union Jack, a huge Union Jack covering the whole desk, and a Bible in front of him, and he conducted the ceremony, and then we went and stayed at a hotel, the Scheherazade, I think it was, in Baghdad for a couple of nights. And then we went up into Kurdistan to Shaklawa in the Land Rover and had a honeymoon up in the mountains for about 10 days. And then came back and, you know, I got on. We had a house allocated and you know, I used to go out each day. In the summer, where the temperatures were really high, we used to go out about 5 in the morning and finish at 2, because it was so hot, work-wise. Yeah. I mean, and in the kitchen, Jean said we found, you know, the temperature would be as high as 105 inside.
Did Jean stay with you for a while then, once you were married?
She stayed until we left. We were going to stay for something like 2 or 3 years, but they had a revolution after about 2 months.
Yeah.
So we sat it out for about 6 months. But when the consulate decided to go back home, we thought that this was time for us to go. So we left. After we were married for about six months, and then we came back at home. But they had the revolution, and the embassy was blown up, and all the records were lost, including our marriage records.
Oh, yeah.
So it was only our copy. As soon as we got home, Jean took our copy and went up to Somerset House, and we were formally registered.
So when a country is busy having a revolution, do people like you still get paid?
We did, because, you know, the consulate that I work for, consultants I work for, yes, we were paid. In fact, we'd saved quite a lot of money, and the trick was that to put it into the branch of my bank in the Channel Islands in Guernsey, and if it stayed in Guernsey for a full tax year, you could bring it back into England without paying any tax on it, which I did.
Very clever.
Yes.
Well, from Baghdad. All right, you beat a retreat from Baghdad.
Yes.
And wound up in Middlesex. I can't imagine a greater difference.
Well, I decided that I wanted to work in the measurement of rivers is the sort of work I wanted to do. And when I got back, we were living in London, in Holland Park, and reading the journals, looking for jobs. And I got a job with Middlesex County Council as a hydrological surveyor to measure the flow of the rivers of Middlesex, particularly rivers and the flood flows, you know, because the design of river channels is based on the 100th year flood flow. Mm. And then I held that for about 3 years and got a job as the hydrologist to Lincolnshire River Authority, measuring the rivers of Lincolnshire again, particularly flood flows, measuring and analysing the flows. And I also had to set up a flood warning operations room to give warning of river and tidal flooding. And I had that job for about 23 years.
So it must be a fascinating occupation being a hydrologist and studying river flows.
Well, it is. It's because, first of all, you spend half your time on the river, walking and surveying rivers. It's not an, you know, as a,
not a desk job.
Not a desk job.
Yeah.
But also there's a sort of primitive, primeval sort of ness about it, because the river is in charge. The river decides how it's going to flow. And as an engineering job, if you worked for an electricity company or a water board or a gas board, as an engineer, you design the system, you install it, you decide what goes into it, and decide the output. Whereas as a river authority, you've already inherited the river, which has been there for millions of years. God decides what goes in, and the tide decides what comes out. You've a very tenuous control, very tenuous indeed. So it's you feel sort of humbled.
So does a river have the same tranquility and ferocity that you can experience in the Antarctic?
Oh, yes. I mean, if you've got a flood on your hands, it's about 5 days and you don't get that much sleep at all. I used to run the operations room. And it's very important, if you can, to measure the flood, you know, because that gives you the design data for the design of the river channel.
Mm.
And in Lincolnshire, in the Fen... The land level was below high tide level, so they had to build great sea defences, embanked sea defences, and you can get certain tides that will overtop these.
The famous one was Norfolk, wasn't it, in
1952? 53.
Yes,
Lincolnshire in 53. Well, what happens is that out in the Atlantic, you know, in about a 1,000-mile diameter, if you have a depression, the barometric, you know, is a depression, the water level actually rises about 3 feet. And then if that's followed by a northerly wind, it pushes this hump of water north, and then if the wind changes to the east, it pushes it round the north of Scotland. It's at the top end of the
North Sea,
but and then you get a northerly that pushes it down the North Sea. This is about once every 6 months or so. It's not, but it happens.
Mm.
But when you think that the width of the North Sea from Scotland to Norway is about 300 miles. And then it narrows down to the Dover to about 20 miles.
Yeah.
As the wind pushes this hump of water down the North Sea, the funnel causes the amplitude to rise. So, and then you get a happening when it gets to, say, Lincolnshire, the wind has swung round and it's easterly. And it just pushes it on the shore. So you get this huge wave coming over the sea defences. But in 1953, there was also the sea defences during the war had been used for tank training, and they had been seriously demolished.
Mm. So the defences were...
So the first one of the things that had to be done after that 53 flood was to raise the sea defences to a much greater level.
So were you making that kind of recommendation in your job?
In terms of rivers
in Lincolnshire. Yeah.
Yes. I wasn't. I was measuring tide, measuring waves, but not. Somebody else did the design of the sea defences.
But you were showing the need. You were demonstrating the need.
No, I was just, you know, if it was possible, measuring the height of a particular wave. With rivers, I was involved in analysing for flood flows, but also for droughts, because we had a number of reservoirs, and the critical design of a reservoir is that it's got to survive a three-year drought. So what's the lowest flows in the river to supply the reservoir? So I had to measure droughts as well as floods.
And rather, it sounds like 25 years later we still haven't quite mastered it yet, have we?
Well, you never do, because it's constantly changing. I mean, the rainfall pattern changes, and the other thing, that as you get more and more urban areas, the runoff is much greater. Mm. You tend to design the river on the worst probable flood once every 100 years.
So did your 3 years in the Antarctic, in any way, in the same way that your army service prepared you for the Antarctic, did your 3 years in the Antarctic prepare you in any way for your later career?
Oh, yes, because in the Antarctic you tend to be involved in doing met observations and some surveying, and that helped a great deal. And the use of instruments, you know, the philosophy of measurement.
How do you rate those 3 years in the 84 years of your life so far, the Antarctic years?
Well, they were quite a turning point, because I was 24 when I went down, and if I hadn't have gone down, you know, my career would have taken a different direction. I think I would have gone aboard somewhere or other on some engineering project. But being in the Antarctic, you get a sense that you can cope, so that whatever might happen, You get a bit of a sort of confidence that you can cope with it, and that stays with you. Possibly, you know, maybe you're quite wrong, but you that feeling that you can, whatever might happen, you'll be able to cope with it.
So it's had a lasting legacy.
Yes, I think it has.
In 60 years at five.
And also in planning work in the Antarctic, you're always, certainly when you're sledging, you're balancing your food rations against the number of days you've got, and contingency. You've always got to think of a contingency. Well, when I was designing, you know, when I was planning projects for rivers, this sense of planning and contingency stays with me. And in engineering, when you're estimating a project, you have a 5% contingency element, where there might be some unknown, the weather or this or that, but the contingency planning in engineering projects is part of it. And I think I was influenced by some degree from life in the Antarctic.
Have you ever yearned to go south again?
No. No.
You said that very firmly, Ken.
Having left the Antarctic and worked in Iraq and got married, I would have preferred to have gone to other tropical places to work. On the other hand, the prospects seemed best on working on the rivers of England. I applied in Australia to go there, and I applied on the Mackenzie in Canada. In Canada, they wanted hydrological surveys, and they wanted somebody who could drive dogs, dog teams. And I thought, oh, that'll be interesting. And applied, and it got an acknowledgement. And then I got a letter saying we apologise. What we hadn't pointed out was that the job is a civil service appointment, and as it's a civil service appointment, you've got to be a Canadian national. So, so I didn't get that one. So I stayed in England, but I could easily have gone somewhere else. Mm. Well, us together. And then when I was 57, I got this offer of early retirement. I was bowled over, 57, went home, and we did our sums, and we only had another year to pay on the mortgage, so we worked it out and decided to take it. On the other hand, I was due for quite a promotion, but what based my thinking was based on the fact that I was already well aware that I was out of date. I was behind the times. The computer was making more and more of an inroad. And as an engineer, I'd done all my calculations with a slide rule and log tables. And I found that although I used the computer, I didn't really comprehend it. And any promotion was going to put me at a disadvantage. So I thought it timely to go. And then about 10 of us went in our mid-50s and late-50s, and you thought, well, the collective experience that's just going through the door, and it was a time when the pension funds were really overflowing with money, and I think that was what influenced the authorities.
It's been marvellous talking to you, and we'll call it a day there.
Yeah,
Ken, thank you very much indeed.